we're in the 28th chapter of Isaiah, and we were down to about verse 14 or 15. Let me just review briefly what we pointed out in chapter 28. Beginning with chapter 28, you have a series of, I believe, six woes. The first woe is against the rulers in Samaria, and the priests and the prophets in Jerusalem. And he moves on then to include the rulers that are among them. Now all of these he accuses of being drunkard. They're intoxicated, had no regard or respect for God. So the first six verses deal with Samaria, the capital of Ephraim, and then beginning with verse 7, he turns now to the priests and the prophets in Jerusalem. And these raise the question, whom will he teach knowledge? And they ridicule Isaiah as teaching them as one would a babe. Here a little, there a little. Line upon line, rote type of teaching. I could take a child and teach it line by line. Well, they were ridiculing him. His answer was that, nay, but by men of strange lips will God teach you. He's going to bring the Assyrians, and they will be God's instrument and teach these drunken sots what is right by deeds. Teach them what if they won't hear his word, teach them in deeds. Now down in verse 14, now he turns to the rulers and says, let's hear verse 7. He talks about the priests and the prophets. They reel with strong drink, swallowed up of wine. Now down in 14, now he turns to the rulers. Now he says, wherefore, hear this word of Jehovah, you scoffers, that rule this people that is in Jerusalem. Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol are we in agreement. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, it shall not come unto us. For we have made lies our refuge, and unto falsehood have we hid ourselves. Now I doubt seriously if they said that in so many words. They said that by their actions. What they had done, they had sought to make agreement with either the idols or with Egypt or with Assyria, here and in these lies, while they sought refuge from the overflowing scourge that God said, I'm going to bring against you, bring over the land. So now then he said, therefore thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone of sure foundation. He that believeth shall not be in haste. And I will make justice the line, and righteousness the plummet. And the hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters shall overflow the hiding place. Now, I read to that point last time, before we stopped, but I hadn't made any comment on this. Now, the point of that is this. These rulers, in making their agreement with Assyria, or making an agreement with Egypt, and probably it was with Egypt at this time, they made an agreement, and hiding behind idolatry, they left God out. So in that, they were saying, well, we've made an agreement, a covenant with death. We've made lies our refuge. We've made falsehood our covering. Therefore, when this overflowing scourge of judgment shall come through, it will not come unto us. It will not affect us. Now, God said, I laid in Zion for a foundation of stone. Now, what would that stone be at that time? It would be Jehovah himself, as set forth in his word. Now, Peter quotes that in 1 Peter 2, 6 to 8, and applies it to Christ. Now, from our point of view, Christ is a tried stone. He's a stone that's been put to the test and proved to be divine, to be of God. Now, back there, God had demonstrated himself to be the foundation on which they should build, and the only place in which they could find refuge. So the only place man can ever find a true refuge is in God, or the provision that God has made. Now, and that's what he's saying here in this, a tried stone, precious cornerstone, and he that believeth shall not be in haste. Now, when Peter quotes that, he says he shall not be put to shame. Now, here he'll not be in haste to make an agreement or a covenant with some nation or somebody other than God. To Peter's point of view, it would be to his shame, and it would be. Now, notice this, I'll make justice the line. Now, here he uses a figure here from the architect or the builder. Now here you drop the plummet, and here you stretch your line. And so as you drop the plummet and build according to the straight
line from up here where you dropped it down to the plummet. Why, you keep the wall straight. Now here you draw your line out yonder, and you keep it perpendicular. Now then you keep it straight. So the true builder builds a perpendicular wall, build it straight, so that it will stand. Now God said, I'm going to make justice the line, and righteousness the plummet. And so as a man builds according to justice and righteousness, which the psalmist said are the foundation of God's throne. Now if I build according to that, I'm going to build a secure wall in which I can find refuge and in which I can find protection. A beautiful picture as we look at it there. Now he moves on to say, and he says, now notice verse 17, I'll make justice the line, righteousness the plummet, and the hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the water shall overflow the hiding place. And now he goes on and he says, your covenant with death shall be annulled, and your agreement with Sheol shall not stand. That's death in the unseen world, in the Hadean world. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, then you shall be trodden down by it. As often as it passeth through, it shall take you, for morning by morning shall it pass through, by day and by night, and it shall be naught but terror to understand the message. Now, as this nation comes, as the Assyrians come against the Jews here, against Judah, now, as you're taking city, village after village, and city after city, it's naught but terror to understand the message, because it's on its way to Jerusalem. And Isaiah said in the 8th chapter, verse 8, the overflowing flood shall come even unto the neck. Well, that means then that it wouldn't destroy Jerusalem. But they didn't understand that, but that's what God's promised. So it would never get to Jerusalem this time unless there not be enough to turn to God. So justice is the line, righteousness the plummet, by which to build. Now then, a refuge of lies and falsehood going to be swept away. Now note this next, which is probably a parabolic statement here, for it says, the bed is shorter than that a man can stretch himself on it, and the covering narrower than that he can wrap himself in it. All right, tall person. Now, I'm not really tall, but I've tried to sleep on a short bed with a narrow blanket, and it's not a very comfortable way to get a nice rest. And if it turns real cold, it freezes to death that way. So this is the point there. Now, let me notice that this occurred three different times in the history, in man's history here, or twice already, once it will. All right, now here we're back there in Isaiah. And Isaiah now declares here this, the overflowing scourge is going to pass through, but you may come in with death, and with Sheol you would agree with. That same thing happened in Matthew, the 27th chapter, 28th chapter, I guess it is, when the Jews went to Pilate and made a covenant with him. They first said, when Pilate asked them, what shall I do with your king? They said, crucify him. And then he said, shall I crucify your king? They said, we have no king but Caesar. All right, now they were making lies a refuge. They hated old Caesar. And then also, after Jesus had been crucified and put and buried, then they came to Pilate here in the that 27th chapter here. 27th chapter, and beginning with verse 62. Now on the morrow, which is the day after the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees were gathered together unto Pilate, saying, sir, we remember that that deceiver said, while we yet alive, after 3 days I rise again. Command therefore that the sepulchre be made sure until the third day, lest haply the disciples come and steal him away, and say unto the people, he is risen from the dead. And the last error will be worse than the first. Pilate said unto them, ye have a guard, go make it as sure as you can. So they went and made the sepulchre sure, sealing the stone, the guard being with them. All right, now what had they done? They were making a covenant with death. They were making an agreement with Sheol that Jesus Christ would not be raised from the dead. So, and in doing that, they were making their own preparation to get rid of him. That what he said in the 24th chapter of Matthew about the destruction of Jerusalem, that would never come to pass. So here was the destruction of Jerusalem in the 24th chapter. Here in the 27th chapter, they are making Christ's death secure. And when the overflowing scourge comes upon them, it will pass on them.
But on the third day, Christ is raised from the dead, and then 37 years later, the Romans, whose favor they courted, came and destroyed their city. They made a covenant with death. With Sheol, they thought they were in agreement. But God said, when the overflowing scourge shall pass through, it will be naught but terror to understand the message. For it says, the hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the water shall overflow the hiding place. Now what I'm pointing out is, you have a parallel here. You have a parallel in the back here with what happened back here in the Jews back here in Isaiah. Now here with the Jews here, all right, in Isaiah, this 28th chapter here. They made the covenant with death and shield of agreement. Now, you have a parallel here with the Jews, again, this time in Matthew, the 27th chapter here, where they were making a covenant with death and an agreement with shield. Now, there's another parallel, and that's the present. That's men of the present day to day who are making an agreement with death and a covenant with shield by hiding, making lies their refuge. They're hiding behind atheism, behind humanism, behind false religions, behind all of these things. Those are nothing in the world but attempts to hide from God. And so they say, oh, there's no resurrection, there's no judgment. But once more, there's going to be an overflowing scourge pass through. And it's going to be naught but terror to understand the message. I think you have a three-time occurrence of this. The Jews back yonder, when they tried to hide from God behind their lies and the falsehood. But the overflowing scourge came with the Babylonians, and they were carried away into captivity. Didn't come into Assyria, but it came. And over here with Matthew, here they made another one there. The overflowing scourge came with the Romans, and they destroyed the city. Now, the man today is making the same kind of a mistake, making some preparation for the future, either by unbelief or atheism or what have you. Here, and communism, and all of that. I'll just take atheism in... atheism and infidelity, communism, false religion, and humanism, rather, false, all those are covenants they're making with death and agreements with Sheol. But the overflowing scourge is just as sure to come and sweep away the refuge of lies as it did when the Babylonians came and when the Romans came. There's only one secure hiding place. When the floods come, and that's on the rock that God laid in Zion. Behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation, a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, sure foundation. He didn't believe it, shall not be in haste to put to shame. Great lesson. I think it's a great lesson. Bed's too short and the blanket's too narrow. Now, he goes on to say here, for Jehovah will rise up as in Mount Perazim. He will be wroth as in the valley of Gibeon. Now, Perazim was when David there destroyed a group of people at Baal Perazim, and the other in the valley of Gibeon, when Gibeon destroyed, the Gibeonites destroyed the Midianites. That's when God raises up and does it. But now notice, for that he may do his work, his strange work, and bring to pass his act, his strange act. What is God's strange work? Don't turn that down back on. Are y'all warm out there? I'm real hot up here, but anyway, thank you. Right now, what is going to be his strange act, his strange work? It's going to be the fact that he brings the judgment against his own people. That was the thing that was so strange about him. They were his people. They'd rejected him. They'd made lies their refuge. They'd made a covenant with death and all of that. And God is going to sweep away the refuge of lies. He's going to overflow the hiding place. He's going to bring every one of them into judgment. Well, all right. That's a great paragraph, a great lesson. And it's just as practical and applicable to us today as it was for them back then. Now, the prophet here gives four imperative commandments. Here's a parable from agriculture. And that parable there, or that illustration, was from architecture, the building of a wall, plummet, and a line. Now then he turns to agriculture and offers here a parable from agriculture. Give ye ear, now four commands, and hear my voice, hearken, and hear my speech. There are four imperative commands: to give ear and to hear and to hearken and to give heed unto what God says. Trying to get them to do something to avert that catastrophic judgment that was coming. And that's what our preaching ought to be doing today. Try to turn people away from it, from the falsehood of lies, prepare them for judgment. Now here he asks the question, does he that ploweth to sow
that he that ploweth to sow plow continually, doth he continually open and harrow his ground? Well, certainly not. He used some common sense, doesn't he? If a man's going to plant out, he doesn't just keep plowing and plowing and plowing. That's why he's going to do some planting if he ever gets a harvest, isn't he? That's what common sense teaches a man, not to just keep on plowing and plowing and plowing. And he said, when he leveled the face thereof, doth he not scatter abroad the pitches and scatter the cumin, and put in the wheat in rows, and the barley in the appointed place, and the spelt in the border thereof? I don't know just what that spelt was, some kind of fodder for camels, but I don't know why I put it on the border. They did. But the point is, now when he uses common sense when he prepares the ground. He uses common sense when he plants it. He doesn't plant those little herbs like he does the wheat and all of that. He plants them according to the seed and the crop that he expects. He uses common sense in that. Right? For his God doth instruct him aright and doth teach him. God, who is the author of wisdom and the author of common sense, well, he teaches us some common sense. Some of us don't ever learn the lesson, maybe, but if we'll try, God teaches us something. Just use a little common sense. Somebody said to Brother Floyd Thompson one time, when they explained something to me, he said, that doesn't make common sense, does it? Of course, if this isn't the Bible, it is common sense. That's right. You don't get anything out of the Bible, it's common sense. It's all good common sense. And I did that teaching. For the fishes are not threshed. Now comes the threshing. There's the preparing of the ground. There's the planting. Now here's the harvest. Now he said, for the fishes are not threshed with a sharp threshing instrument. Neither is a cart wheel turned about upon the cumin. A little bitty old little herbs there, little seeds there, about upon the cumin. But the fishes are beaten out with a staff, and they come in with a rod. Yeah, you gather those and put them out here and beat them out like this. You don't run a great big wheel over them. You're running them. And furthermore, bread grain is ground, for he will not be always thrashing it. A man better just keep on rolling his wheels over the grain there. And after a while, crushed, it didn't fit to anything. Then you can't make bread out of it. Use common sense. When you have sufficiently pull this wheel, it generally it was a round board with spikes in it that would thresh it out, for he will not be always thrashing it. And though the wheel of his cart and his horses scatter it, he doth not grind it. He doesn't just keep on till he has it ground. This also cometh forth from Jehovah of hosts, who is wonderful in counsel and excellent in wisdom. In other words, the farmer uses common sense in plowing the land, in planting, and in thrashing. Now, what's the appeal there? It's appeal that God's going to use common sense, his divine sense, rather, in his judgments, and I'm to use common sense in listening to him and doing what he said. I told him I'm teaching a lady out about 35 miles west of east of where we live, a man and his wife, thought they were doing fine. I discovered Monday night when I went out there that a problem is she doubts the existence of God. I had assumed that anybody that wanted to study the Bible believed in God. So I just started there and tried to teach what the book said. And after about 30, 40 minutes on that, that was my lesson. I said, well, next time that's all we're going to study. But I think common sense will teach anybody that will look at the universe, look at what's here on this earth, and look at himself and his own mind and intelligence. Common sense teaches him that he came from an intelligent source. Something cannot come from nothing. Something is, therefore something was. I think that's a logical syllogism. Now, something is, what is? Intelligence is. Therefore, intelligence was. The television is a wonderful thing to me to look at. I don't know how in the world it works. I don't know how all these colors and sounds are going through the air here. I guess if we could have inmate television, it would run crazy. But somehow it gets into that thing. Now you see it and hear it. Here's an airplane that weighs many, many tons. Couldn't possibly get off the ground. Yet in a few moments here, you're way up down and flying along. And I still don't believe the thing can get off the ground, but somehow it does. But what did man use in putting that together? He used intelligence to take what he found here in the way of laws and material, put the material together, exercising the laws, and the machine flies, and the television gives you a colored picture with sound on it. when I took intelligence, you could just throw some glass and some wood and some metal into something and turn it over like this, and that's why television would come out. You've got to use intelligence there. Right? So to me, common sense would teach me that there's a supreme being. I couldn't question that. She asked me if I ever doubted. No, I never had doubt in my life about God. I mean, I doubted last time whether I knew truth or something or not, but I didn't work together. But my point is that this, to me, is an emphasis on man's common sense giving heed to God's divine sense, that from which it came. Listen to it. Good lesson, isn't it? I think it is. All right, let me move to 29. Now we come to another woe. I want to quote it whole here, but the footnote says woe here. That is a woe too, and it is a woe. Woe Ariel. Ariel, the city where David encamped. Add ye year to year, let the feast come round. Then will I and I know three times God uses I here, and then will I distress Ariel, and there shall be mourning and lamentation, and she shall be unto me as Ariel. And I will encamp against thee round about, and will lay siege against thee with posted troops, and I will lay siege works against thee, and thou shalt be brought down, and shall speak out of the ground, and thy speech shall be low out of the dust, and thy voice shall be as of one that hath a familiar spirit out of the ground, and thy speech shall whisper out of the dust. Alright, now first of all, let's look at the word Ariel. Now, there is a question about this word Ariel as to whether it should be translated heart of God or lion of God. Now, and I don't know, I'm not a Hebrew student, but here is Ariel. The last word is E-L. And it's Ariel, that's always God. When the word, Hebrew word ends in E-L, then it involves God, Ariel. So it's either lion of God or it's the heart of God. Now, I think it's the heart of God. I realize that God shows great strength in what he does, and that you might think of it as the other, but I think it's the heart of God. That is, Jerusalem, and it stands for Jerusalem here. Yeah, it's Jerusalem. What it is it? Jerusalem there. Oh, it's here. Jerusalem Zion. Which is called Ariel. Jerusalem Zion. Now, Jerusalem had been selected by Jehovah as the place where sacrifices would be offered. It would be his dwelling place, be the place where God would dwell among his people, and it would be also the place here where the sacrifices should be offered. Now here's a woe unto it, and it was the city where David encamped. David took the city and made it into the capital. He encamped there as his capital. Right? And add you year to year, let the feast roll up. Now I think that means, some think that means a definite time, 2 years. I don't. I think that in this chapter, this woe condition, God's going to bring a judgment against it, and there shall be mourning and lamentation, and she shall be unto me as Ariel. That is, I think, the heart of God, after that I brought the judgment against her, she will be unto me as a true heart of God. That is, a place where the sacrifices will be offered. Sacrifices that I will accept will be offered there. And she shall be unto me as Ariel. And I will encamp against thee round about. I know God's going to encamp around about her. And will lay siege against thee with posted troops. In other words, I'll bring troops against you. And as a place where my sacrifices should have been offered, which you have so desecrated, I'm going to bring judgment against you. I'll bring them myself. And I will raise siege works against thee. Thou shalt be brought down, and shall speak out of the ground that is brought low, and mutter as one whispers. And it will be brought so low, it will be as a whisper. Mormons take this and say this is Joe Smith. Well, I think he was one of those fellows, one of the chirpers or wizards. I think that's what he was. But that's not what they meant. That they found these plates in the soil there. Right, and I shall speak out of the ground, and thy speech shall be low out of the dust. You've been brought so low, thy voice shall be as of one that hath a familiar spirit, as a chirper. So if you went to one of the other familiar, well, they whispered or chirped or acted as a ventriloquist, oftentimes ventriloquism. They came to be speaking. Of one that hath a familiar spirit out of the ground, and thy speech shall whisper out of the dust. Alright, now that's what's going to come unto
unto Eliab. So I think he's dealing here with a spiritual conflict and consequences that are going to come as a result of their turning away from God. Now next, he goes on, but the multitude of thy foes shall be like small dust, and the multitude of the terrible ones as chaff that passeth away. Yea, it shall be in an instant suddenly. Alright? Now, although you're going to be brought low, the enemies whom I will use against you, against Jerusalem, Zion, is Ariel. The troops I'm going to, they're going to be as dust, but I've used them. I blow them as chaff, as dust, out into space. They'll be gone. Alright? Now, here maybe the alternate reading is better here. Now he says, she shall be visited as Jehovah of hosts with thunder and with earthquake and great noise with a whirlwind and tempest and the flame of a devouring fire. Now the footnote says, alternate reading, there shall be a visitation from Jehovah of this. Now I think he's talking about the visitation of Jehovah upon Zion, Jerusalem, upon the whole people because of their wickedness there. You remember back in the fourth chapter, God would purge them with blasting. The blasting of two different things, forget it now. But the blasting there of his own breath and all that. Well, I think that's what you have here. The judgment of God against his people, his strange word, who had become unfit to be the place for sacrifice to be offered unto him. But the enemies that will come against you will be as dust or chaff that I can blow upon and they're gone. So I think that's still true. I think God still executes his judgments. But she shall be visited of Jehovah of hosts with thunder, with earthquake, with great noise, with whirlwind and tempest, and the flame of devouring fire. Those are all expressions of judgment against his people and the capital that have become so wicked. And I wouldn't say that that's any particular time, or the Assyrians or the Babylonians. I think he's talking here about the judgment that we discussed in chapter 24-27. And here is a great judgment against the forces of evil that stand against me. I'm going to use them against my wicked people, then I'm going to destroy them. And the multitude of all the nations that fight against Israel, even all that fight against her and a stronghold, and that distress her, shall be as a dream, a vision of the night. Now, what actually were the forces against Israel, the heart of God? Wickedness. The wickedness of the people. That was the thing that brought the judgment upon them. And so I think that's what he's still talking about here, is that those that fight against Ariel is not necessarily the Assyrians of the Babylonians. He uses them as the final judgment, all right. But it's the wickedness of the people themselves that have destroyed the heart of God. What is the worst enemy that we have today? Is it those who are fighting the church from without? Or is it the indifference and apostasy and sins and wickedness within? It's that within. You can never destroy the church of God from without. It can only be destroyed from within. And I mentioned to you the paper that Brother Charlie gave me that came to the church here. Two men there and the congregations that had gone to the baptism of the Holy Spirit, speaking in tongues. Direct revelation from God, the charismatic and all that, they introduced instrumental music into their worship. Churches of Christ now, I'm talking about Church of Christ now, did this. All right? Now, when you get that kind of a condition from within, what's God going to do with a group? Of course, the righteous will always stand. There's going to always be a remnant. So, not as it was back there, some particular spot or one particular congregation. The righteous will always stand. God will always recognize it, but when within the congregation, within so many of the members of the church, you get this spirit to characterize them today. Can it stand? No. There's an apostasy. I think we're already in the apostasy right now. In so many parts of the country, we're in an apostasy right now. All right? But in the midst of that, now what's going to happen? The church will be, we're just going to another denomination, rejected of God. Well, all right, and it shall be as when a hungry man dreameth, and behold, he eateth. But he awaketh, and his soul is empty. Now, he's talking here about Ariel here, those that fight against Ariel. He will be as a hungry man trying to destroy, but they wake up, and the soul is empty. Or as when a thirsty man dreameth, and behold, he drinketh. But he awaketh, and behold, he is faint, and his soul hath appetite. So shall the multitude of all the nations be that fight against Mount Zion. Now, over in Ezekiel, we studied Ezekiel a year or two ago. Over in Ezekiel now, we have in chapter 38 and 39, we have Gog of Magog. And this Gog of Magog symbolized all of the heathen forces that had tried to destroy God's people back there. They were all destroyed by God. Now, over in Revelation 20, here you have the devil is loose for a little season. He gathers Gog and Magog together to come up against the camp of the saints. What does Gog and Magog in Revelation stand for? All of the spiritual enemies that, in a final effort, will seek to destroy all the work of God, destroy the church of the Lord. So, we may be in that now. I wouldn't be surprised when we're into it. I wouldn't argue we are or aren't, because I don't know. My conviction is we may already be into that period when Satan is loose, gathering these spiritual and moral forces of evil against the camp of the saints in a last effort to destroy all that God has done. Then will come the Savior, and the devil will be cast in the lake of fire, the final judgment, and this earth life will be over. I don't know how near that is. No, I bet man be a fool trying to say it, because we don't know. But it does seem to me that we're entering into that period where all the forces of evil are now combining themselves, drugism, false religion, force, destruction, all of that, in an effort to destroy everything's worthwhile. Yes, I think we may be getting into it. I'm not saying we are. I'm just saying we may be into that little period there. Well, all right. So here then is all the fight against Zion, against God's people, they're going to be brought low. They're going to be defeated. Truth and God's people are going to triumph. But it's only in our faith and faithfulness that we're going to triumph. If our life contributes to that of the forces of evil against God and his forces of right, we'll be in that camp that's destroyed. I've got to be in the right camp in Zion. We're coming to Mount Zion. I've got to stand there. Well, now he said, tarry ye and wonder. Now, the people's amazement's expressed here. They just can't believe this. Tarry you and wonder. Take your pleasure and be blind. They are drunken, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. They were drunk on what? They were drunk on their idolatry. They were drunk on power. They were drunk on their own wisdom. They were drunk on those things just like the world is today. Our nation today is drunk. Just as drunk as, we say, drunk as the Lord. Just as drunk as it can be. But not on wine. It's drunk on the ignorance of God. It's drunk on false religion. It's drunk on atheism. It's drunk on humanism. It's drunk on these things. It's intoxicated. It doesn't see straight in anything. Can't walk a straight line morally. And you read and listen to the television and you just want the newscast where all you hear on there is AIDS and crookedness and corruption and all that sort of thing. What's before us? Judgment. All right? So we're drunk. Staggering around drunk. And they're like those priests and prophets back there, that the table was filled with vomit. The table was symbolic of the spiritual food of the prophets and priests. It wasn't fit for anything. What's the spiritual food that's being offered to the world today? What's it worth? Not fit for a thing on earth. Full of vomit. Of a religiously drunk people that know not God. I think this is what the prophet's talking about. I think he does a good job of it. I think we've got his point here. Alright, they stagger but not with strong drink. For Jehovah hath poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep. Now notice up there in verse 9, take your pleasure, you blind. They are drunken. Alright, now they were blind because of their own stupidity and because they refused to see what God was doing. But God says here, I have poured out upon you a spirit of deep sleep. Could he have done it if they hadn't wanted him to? They hadn't allowed? No. No, God doesn't want to do that. But if an individual is determined not to recognize God, and just like Paul said, that because they received not a love for the truth, therefore God sent them a working of delusion, that they might believe a lie, that they all might be damned. Who believed not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Right? So, God can only use me or act toward me as I lie. He made it that way. That's his own prerogative. His own creative power did that. Right? And to close your eyes, the prophets, those who are supposed to be giving you truth, close their eyes because they didn't want the truth. And your heads of the seers hath he covered. And all vision is become unto you as the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned, saying, read this, I pray thee. And he said, I cannot, for it is sealed. And the book is delivered to him that is not learned, saying, read this, I pray thee. And he said, I'm not learned. So your sleep here and your stupidity here, the spirit of deep sleep is upon you. And now you're just like an individual. He'll take a book and give it to the learned man. He said, it's sealed. And a seal, remember, it was rolled up on a stick, and here it was sealed. I can't read it, it's sealed. Hand it to another fellow and said, you read the ignorant fellow. He said, I'm ignorant. I had a little happened. He said, I ain't learned reading yet. And so he hadn't learned how to read yet. And so what God's doing is as a sealed book blind, to those blind people. They couldn't see the signs of the times. And the Lord said, for as much as this people draw nigh unto me with their mouth, and with their lips do they honor me, but have removed their heart far from me. Now, Jesus quoted that, Matthew 15:8-9, applied it to the people of his day. His people draw nigh unto me with their lips, honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. That's because of so much religion today. But have removed their heart far from me, and that fear of me is a commandment of men which had been taught them. That is, fear means reverence or respect. For whatever respect they have for God is not what God taught them, but is what men have taught them. And you've seen that over the television scandal here lately here. All right, what kind of wisdom? I know those little men preach some fine sermons. I don't belittle that. I'm not belittling that. Some fine sermons. But my point is, when it comes right down to telling a man what to do to be saved and what the church is and how we're to live before him, I don't do much of that. All right? And so here, the fear that they are teaching or the reverence for God is a commandment of men, not what God said. You take Billy Graham. I used to listen to him once in a while. I never liked to listen to Billy Graham, but I would once in a while. But when he comes, he preached a pretty good sermon. Get up to the end, now, in telling people what to do to be saved, what would he do? Just believe on the Lord. Hold up your hand. We'll pray for you while you are. Roberts used to say, you touch the television, man. We'll pray for you with your hand on television. Now, that kind of fear of God or respect for God is from whom? That's from men. That's not from God. God said, you believe and you repent of your sins. You be baptized for the remission of your lives to walk in newness of life and to give me your heart and your life. That's what God says. So that fear is a fear which men have taught them. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. And the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. I'm going to work a work among you, and your ears will tingle when it takes place. Because that's what I'm going to do. That looks back here then to this his work back here that he said he was going to do unto them back here earlier. I read it a while ago when he said here that he would do his work, his wonderful work, a marvelous work among them. And when it is, it'll be a work of judgment. I don't have time to get into this next one, so because it continues on, I want to say some things about that. So that'll be a pretty good place, I guess, to stop. Do you have a question over what we said tonight, over this lesson? I guess we could go a little faster, but I want to emphasize what Isaiah said. When we get through, you may not be able to teach the book of Isaiah. Or you may find a lot of things in it that you don't understand still. But one thing I want you to do know when we get through, God is in control of his universe. Righteousness is going to triumph. Wickedness is going to go down the drain. Wickedness and unbelief and disobedience is going to be destroyed by God. And the church today can no more ignore God and set up its own standards than they could. Could the Jews back there? Could do it. So let's learn the lesson. And let's keep it before our hearts all the time. So we'll start with verse 15 next time, and the class is excused. And we'll go on down to finish that and take chapter 30 next time. I think we can finish that and take chapter 30 the same tomorrow. Class is excused.